You're listening to a Dwell Community Church production. If you'd like to check out more resources, visit dwellcc.org.
Okay, so I'm here to talk to you about race and the gospel, Christ, our common object of love. Those of you who don't know, I'm teaching a class here as a wraparound course on theology and race. And two of the sessions of our class... Well, this is one of them. So these are the breakout sessions. So in many ways, I love that you get to kind of eavesdrop on some of the conversations that we get to have in the class. This is also a shameless plug for how cool our classes are, right? That was totally self-aggrandizing. I shouldn't have said that. But we're talking about, you know, what does race have to do with the gospel? And how should we understand things like race, racism, and human identity more broadly, in the context of what Christ is doing to create, redeem, sustain, and perfect our world. Right? God hasn't left us. God has not abandoned us when it comes to the very hardest things that we face in our lives. But we have to do the hard work of thinking carefully about it, right? And hopefully, us who get paid to be theologians, I know that sounds like a made-up job, it's a real job, hopefully we can help the church to do that. And that's what I want to share a little bit with you about today. Yesterday, it feels like a long time ago, we talked a little bit about how the Bible relates to race. How can we think about biblical texts that don't use words like race, to think about topics like race biblically, right? It turns out it's really hard to do, but we can do it. And so we talked about some strategies and things like that, and we ended with two very divergent ways of thinking about a crucial text, Acts 17, 26, and how that text was used in various different kinds of ways in the hands of people who were wanting to defend segregation or to argue against slavery, and how, you know, the mere presence of a Bible verse is not sufficient. It's using the Bible well. It's using the Bible wisely, right? So today what I want to talk to you about is the state of the conversation within systematic theology. I'm a systematic theologian, that doesn't matter, but like, the state of the conversation within systematic theology about race. And I want to introduce you to a few of the people that I like. I brought books, right? Just show and tell. You can look at them afterwards if you want. I want to introduce you to some really important people who have been helping us to think about race, some of the ways that they diverge, and some of the proposals that they make about how best to do something good in this world, about the conflicts and problems that we see about race. So, that's where we're going. We were talking yesterday about what is race, and I made a distinction between a descriptive task and a normative task. Right? When we talk about things like race, if we want to be properly theological about it, we have to know what we're talking about. We have to know something about the subject matter of what we're talking about. So if we want to have a theological understanding of race, we have to know something about the way race operates in our world today. We can't just talk about it as an abstract concept that's detached from the real lives of ordinary people, right? Christian ethics, systematic theology is accountable to the lives lived by ordinary disciples of Jesus Christ. And that's the descriptive task. We have to be people grounded in the real world so that when we do theology and think theologically, we're accountable to the actual lives of actual people, right? So if we want to say something about what race ought to be, which is the normative task, we have to have a good grasp on what the descriptive task is. And yesterday, we covered a little bit about how race has been understood descriptively. We covered how we went from understanding race as something like a nature or a biological category to race being understood as a social construct. Right? We used to think that race was reducible to biology and served to explain both physical and cultural traits. But given the absence of any actual biological evidence for that claim, race began to be understood as something else, as something developed and practiced by, or developed by cultural practices and expectations. Now, within the social constructionist understanding of race, there are two different sort of compartments or two different ways of breaking that down. We have cultural constructionists and political constructionists. Check that out. I got my transitions going well. All right. It's going to get better too, just wait, right? For a cultural constructionist about race, race is not irreducibly bad. Now, racism is, but racial categories are not irreducibly bad. While they have been used to do unspeakable harm, race is nevertheless a concept that can, through the right efforts, be redeemed. Now, we're going to consider a theological example of this view in just a moment, but think here that racial identity and racial categories and concepts are things that can be redeemed through the right efforts. Additionally, this means that race is not something that's just placed upon somebody, but something we identify with. There's an active component within cultural constructionist understandings of race, right? You identify and you belong. It's something that you appropriate to yourself. On the other hand, political constructionists about race will say that race cannot be redeemed, for the purpose of its production was not good. Race came into existence through highly problematic practices of exploitation and domination, and as a result, it's kind of corrupted all the way down. It had problematic origins, whether in the transatlantic slave trade, in the case of North American racial identity, or something else. But the only means of freeing ourselves from racism's problematic effects is uncovering its problematic origins. Origins that were highly contingent, that didn't have to be the way they are. And then finding new ways to cultivate belonging and social identity. If all of this sounds very weird and nerdy to you, I'll unpack it a little bit more later, but I'm just trying to give you a first initial wash of that. But here, race cannot be redeemed. It's not something with which one identifies, but it's placed upon an individual. Let me give you an illustration. Anybody know who those people are? The Harlem Globetrotters, right? Does anybody know who the Harlem Globetrotters play? The Washington Generals. Can anybody tell me the record of the Washington Generals against the Harlem Globetrotters? Yeah, zero and a whole lot, right? Did they win one? Oh, like a pity game or something? Oh, they got mad. Okay, yeah. So one way to think about systemic racism is to think about it like a Harlem Globetrotters game against the Washington Generals. The Washington Generals show up to a game that was constituted and structured to disfavor them, right? The Harlem Globetrotters, they're gonna dunk on them, right? That's just going to happen. And they're gonna make the Washington Generals look kind of goofy. So if you're a cultural constructionist about race, you think that the way to solve the problem of the Washington Generals getting dunked on by the Harlem Globetrotters is to make the Washington Generals better at basketball. Right? So you train them up so that the Washington Generals are no longer disadvantaged in the kind of way that they have been for so long. You make them as good as the Harlem Globetrotters at basketball by providing the right kinds of resources and so on. If you're a political constructionist about race, right, you think that you start questioning the game altogether, right? Cultural constructionist, you keep playing the game, but you make sure that the Washington Generals end up being as good at basketball as the Harlem Globetrotters. Political constructionist, you start looking around and saying, why are we playing this silly game anyway? I don't know anything about basketball, by the way, so I'm on shaky ground. But so that's the big idea. So once we start turning to the theological literature, we begin to see that these same frameworks for trying to think about race and the best ways to fight against racism map onto these broad considerations. So we have cultural constructionists about race from a theological perspective, the most famous of which is this guy right here, James Cone. Now, James Cone is probably the most famous and influential theologian to have reflected on race. Right? He lived from 1938 to 2018 and taught at Union Theological Seminary in New York City. And for those who are taking the class, he stands at the very end of Lisa Bowens' book, right? Right after we talked about this, after Albert Clegg. Right? In particular, he's taking claims that were made in the 20th century by folks like Albert Clegg and Howard Thurman, and developing them to his own context. In the 60s and 70s, James Cone wrote quite a few very influential books, the most influential of which is this book right here, A Black Theology of Liberation. Now, what's James Cone trying to do in this book? He states the purpose for writing as this. For Cone, he's trying to write in an attempt to answer the question that he and others could not ignore, namely, what has the gospel of Jesus Christ to do with the black struggle for justice in the United States? For Cone, the way to answer that question is to say that God identifies with the oppressed and has shown through his history of interactions with Israel and the church that he's on the side of those who are hurting. He's on the side of the poor, and he's on the side of the least of these. He derives these claims primarily from texts like Matthew 25 and others, right? And part of his project is to redefine and redeem understandings of blackness. Here we are. So for Cone, this is how Cone understands blackness. He says, blackness is an ontological symbol and a visible reality which best describes what oppression means in America. So what is blackness? It's a word that describes what oppression means in America. So here, blackness no longer refers merely to a particular configuration of physical attributes. Blackness is now a symbol for what it means to be oppressed in America. So therefore, black theology's task is to destroy the oppressor's definition of blackness by unraveling new meanings in old tales so that the past may emerge as an instrument of black liberation. So note that here, James Cone takes black theology's task as a redefinition of blackness. It was a concept that was meant for the oppression of black folks, but he wants to undercut and unravel and subvert the usages of that term for the sake of liberation. And in that sense, he's kind of a paradigmatic or exemplary cultural constructionist, right? What we need are better racial categories. So what do? We take these problematic racial categories and we work to redefine them. Now, this is clearest in James Cone's treatment of Christology. James Cone maintains that Jesus is black. Now, just saying that most of the time when I say this in class, people raise their eyebrows because, like, what is he talking about? But you have to remember how James Cone is redefining blackness. Blackness for Cone names the struggle against oppression, right? And so for him, Jesus is the paradigm of someone who stood against and fought against oppression. So he says, the definition of Jesus as black is crucial for Christology if we truly believe in his continued presence today. Taking our clue from the historical Jesus. So he doesn't want to just like make up Jesus after his own image. He's saying, I'm looking at the historical Jesus. The historical Jesus who is pictured in the New Testament as the oppressed one. What else except blackness could adequately tell us the meaning of his presence today? So Cone, through Christology, is looking to furnish the church with better racial concepts, making him a clear example of somebody who is a cultural constructionist about race. Cone is clearly undergoing a cultural constructionist project. Why? He's taking a term, blackness, and redeeming it, taking it back from those who would wield it for oppression and employing it for liberation. Now, there's a history of these kinds of efforts in the United States, right? We take words that were used for oppression and subvert them for liberative purposes. And that's precisely what Cone is doing. Racial concepts can be salvaged, and they can be salvaged precisely through Jesus Christ. So that's one way to think about theology, race, and the gospel, a very influential way. But it's not the only way. Because while there are cultural constructionist Christians, there has been a burgeoning movement to understand race theologically from a political constructionist perspective. Now, over the last 20 years or so, a new development in theology has taken political constructionist understandings of race and given them a distinctly theological register. And it has gone by the name the New Black Theology. There's an article in the Christian Century by that title. And the New Black Theology includes figures like J. Cameron Carter, like Brian Bantam, like Willie Jennings, right, and others. But I want to introduce you to two main figures in this discussion, Willie Jennings and Jonathan Tran. All right? This way you don't have to read the books, right? No, you do. You should. You should still read them. Right. So let's begin with Willie. This is his book here, The Christian Imagination. Jennings wrote this book in 2010. And it's called The Christian Imagination and the Theology and the Origins of Race. Notice in the title, we're already getting a hint about what kind of project he's getting us into. It's a project about the origins of race. As a political constructionist, you would expect precisely that. Let's look into the origins of race to see that it is a concept that cannot be redeemed. I'm getting my steps in today, man. This is... All right. So Jennings's book tells the story of a diseased social imagination, he says. A diseased social imagination inherent within Christianity, where the key symptom is a lack of a sense of place that is replaced by reductionist and dominating racial concepts. When you think Willie Jennings, think two things that cannot go together: race and place. When you lose a sense of place, the only thing that can replace it is a sense of race or is racial identity. Now that's going to be really important, but we're getting ahead of ourselves. A sense of place for Jennings is theologically crucial for understanding human identity. And that's important because when we talk about race, we're talking about human identity. The answer we give to the question, what is a Christian way to understand human identity, is going to implicate our considerations about race in an important way. So when I teach my race class, whenever I teach it, I begin the class with a deceptively simple question that's actually really hard to answer. And that question is this: who are you? Who are you? Right? And everybody hates that question. They're really nice and they smile and they do it anyway because I have to tell them they have to. But I keep that question as broad as possible. Because in an effort to answer that question well, you're going to want to draw on all kinds of resources, right? You know, who's in your family? Who are your friends? What kinds of hobbies and interests you have? Maybe you traveled to get here. Inevitably, however, parts of the answers that are given involve the places where people live, where they have lived previously, where they will live, and so on. So whenever people ask me, who are you? Well, I'm Felipe Doveil. I was born in Brazil. That's an important part of who I am. I live in Grays Lake, Illinois. That's also important and considerably less interesting, right? Right, so a sense of place is pretty important for us for how we understand who we are, right? In the sense that if you want to answer the question, who are you, very often you're going to make recourse to where you've come from and where you live and so on. Is that okay if I asked all of you, who are you? Would you think one of the first things you'd come up with is where you live, where you are, where you've come from? Yeah? Okay. I like talking to people. Okay. So Jennings makes this central to his understanding of race. We are the very things we may invoke spatially, he says. Now I'm going to do my best to sort of denerdify the quotes that I have up on here, okay? So bear with me. I'll be your nerd translator. Okay? Now, a sense of place is massively important for thinking about race because it places the question squarely in the realm of identity. Who are we? Oops. How do we see ourselves? How does God see us? How can I understand myself if I'm also a mystery to myself? Now, if people who do theological anthropology, these are the kinds of questions that we work through. And the value of seeing race within that set of questions is that we can tie various different types of theological considerations to that. So for Jennings, if identity is connected to place, then a proper understanding of identity and therefore place will require a proper doctrine of creation, not just as a claim about where we begin, but also how we're deeply connected to one another. An understanding of the doctrine of providence. How does God govern history? And can we just read off God's intent from what happens in history? That was a common argument for segregation in the 1950s, right? Wow, did God mess up when he let us have Jim Crow laws? Well, that's a doctrine of providence right there. We have to examine that, right? And also, importantly, a doctrine of Christology. Now, during the colonial period, and Jennings kind of makes that, he looks at figures from the 15th century, so the 1400s, to about the 18th century, the 1700s, right around the time where the sort of most monumental acts of colonialism were happening. Something really interesting happened with regard to place, largely at the hands of those who professed to be Christians. What happened? Acts of displacement, or the forced removal of individuals from the places that they belonged to, occurred as Europeans began their massive enterprise of enslaving African human beings. Now think about this. If a sense of place is crucial for understanding who you are, what do you think forcibly stealing somebody from their place does to their identity? Right? It wrecks it. And Jennings uses the image of a slave march to illustrate just what's happening here, juxtaposing it with another famous Christian image. Let me read this for you. So Jennings writes, as he's describing the slave march that was occurring during these times, he says, the march was the demonic reversal of a pilgrimage. On holy pilgrimage, those who walk depend on kind, hospitable strangers to offer them food and sometimes shelter. The pilgrimage, step after step, edging exhaustion, reveals the vulnerability of the human creature and humans longing for God as companion and destiny. Anybody who's read that famous book, Pilgrim's Progress, knows what Jennings is talking about, right? The walking pilgrim calls to God, her creator, hoping to be received home again, not in heaven, but here on earth in communion with the Holy One. For many in the Christian tradition, there was and is no stronger purifier of Christian identity than the aching journey of a pilgrimage. But the march of black flesh in bonds to the sea mocked that journey through reversal. The march of slaves greedily hurried black bodies, I forgot my L there, toward death-filled ports demonically mimicked the divine banishment of the first family from the garden. Slavers would not have imagined this brutal march as a theological act, yet it was so in the most sinister way. African peoples walking together, bound together, first in varieties of rope, and finally, as they approached the ships, bound in chains, left a way of imagining when they left their lands. Now, the notion of exile is biblically very important. Israel was exiled from the land and held in captivity. And 1 Peter 2:11 calls us sojourners and exiles, leading us to believe that we are still in exile and that the Christian life is something like a pilgrimage back to God as we are led back home. God is our home. Jennings says that this is a beautiful and important image. And it was an image denied to slaves who were forced to march in shackles. Whereas Christian pilgrimage reminds us of our true humanity, the slave march ripped away humanity, step by step. It's an act that mocks the true Christian image of a holy life, and it makes enslavement a sick distortion of Christian theological conviction. And Jennings provides us with a concrete example of this. Ironically, the sick distortion of Christian conviction was perpetrated largely by individuals who themselves claimed to be Christians. This is the diseased imagination that Jennings is trying to tell us about. The episode that sticks out in my mind from reading Jennings' book most clearly is an episode that occurred in 1444. A slave ship was arriving in Portugal with 235 slaves. And Prince Henry was eagerly awaiting it with a mass of people. Everybody's really excited because it meant that Portugal, having received the slave ship, would finally become a world power. Everybody's really excited about the arrival of this ship full of slaves. And Prince Henry was going to be at the focal point of all of this excitement. And while all the attention is on him, he decides to bring forward his Christian conviction. And so he ordered a tithe of the slaves to be given to the church as, quote, an act of praise and thanksgiving to God. Little kids, stolen from their homes, were given to the church in an act of worship. Right? This is the diseased imagination Jennings is trying to tell us about. The big idea is this. Displacement, that act by which human beings lose their sense of self because ourselves are so often attached to our sense of place. Displacement was introduced in a large-scale way in the transatlantic slave trade. But for the most part, this displacement, this act of ruining the humanity and identity of an image bearer, was done in recognizably Christian ways like tithing. Right? So, when displacement occurs, something else has to replace it. When we lose that appropriate, divinely designed sense of place, what replaces it, says Jennings, is racial identity. When we lose a sense of place, what we gain instead is a sense of racial identity. Recall that Jennings is a political social constructionist, someone for whom racial categories originated from highly problematic conditions. And these are the conditions. Race cannot be redeemed for Jennings, unlike for Cohn. Race cannot be redeemed because it replaces a sense of place in an individual's identity. When you no longer have a sense of place because it has been stripped away from you, what fills the void is race. Race cannot be redeemed because it only exists because individuals were ripped out of their homes and forced into dehumanizing conditions. So here's what Jennings says. Europeans established a new organizing reality for identities, right? So whereas before a sense of place was the organizing reality for individuals, now something new needed to happen because that sense of place was taken away. Europeans enacted racial agency as a theologically articulated way of understanding their bodies in relation to new spaces and new peoples and to their new power over those spaces and peoples. It was a theological form, an inverted, distorted vision of creation that reduced theological anthropology to commodified bodies. So it takes distinctly Christian tools and resources, twists them up, and makes them into sickly representations used for commodification. So Jennings goes on to say, the only conceptuality strong and wide enough to anchor in a comprehensive way the many identities of people in relation and interaction with one another is race, subtly but unmistakably signified by its always present but unspoken facilitator, whiteness. So Jennings is saying, what happens when you take people's sense of place away? What happens? They are looking, what's needed is some kind of way of organizing social identity, and what we're left with is race. This thing that's only created because people are ripped out of their homes, which is why he says the story of race is also the story of place. Race is a new organizing reality. It enabled one not to just understand individuals in a richly theological way, right? You needed to distort your doctrine of creation in order to enable displacement. Right? You know, the people before us, as a result, are not people to whom we don't belong to one another anymore, as valuable, as cared for. Rather, race, as a replacement for a sense of place, allows individuals to be reduced for the purposes of commodifying them. It's really hard to enslave someone whom you know, whom you care for, someone for whom you show a dimension of responsibility. So they must be reduced. And that reduction happened with Christians armed with theological language, replacing a sense of place with race. So race, says Jennings, replaces place for commodification. Let me give you an illustration of this, just to see how it works. So I just bought my first house with my wife and my kids, right? Thank you. And it was a very hard experience. Any of you who have bought homes will know, right? And part of what made it so hard is that any aspect of human elements that could have been introduced were taken out, Right? I never met the people who owned the house before. I didn't know how they used their living room. I didn't know like what Christmas looked like for them. I didn't know like what their kids did in their bedroom, if they ever had any nightmares that their parents had to come and comfort them in, right? All I knew about this place is a particular set of numbers that was meant to express its value. But how could those numbers adequately express the value of entire human lives, right? Lives that were lived, and similarly, all they knew about us was what we were willing to offer for the house. And if we made the best offer, then great. Our sense of place, of belonging to a particular community, of like knowing the height and shape and width of the trees in the backyard, none of that matters. All that matters is a particular level of commodification. That's what Jennings is talking about when he talks about a lack of a sense of place. When you lose the sense of place, when you lose the sense of being identified with the place that you're at, with valuing God's creation before you, things transform into commodities for use. They become means to our own self-gratification. And it was really hard because now I move into my house and I need to cultivate once again a sense of place, right? I have to make new memories and value it in new ways. But to get the house, I had to reduce it in my eyes to a number, right? And that's what Jennings is talking about. That's what makes racial existence possible, is this reduction of complex human beings to nothing but, right, a commodified value. So he summarizes like this. It should be clear at this point that I am not an advocate of race, nor am I resolved to a race by default position. Neither do I envision a return to life before race. At this point, my concern is to illumine an intensely tangled mistake that could count, couldn't be improved by race, antinomian, intellectual forays. Doesn't matter, I'm bad at PowerPoint, all right? The idea is that Jennings is saying, if we dig and see how race originated, we're going to see that it originated in highly problematic ways that involved the dehumanization of individuals. Which is exactly why he doesn't think that all we need are better racial categories. We need to investigate the game itself, right? So that brings us to the next figure, Jonathan Trant. Here's his book here, right? You can say you've seen it. It's called Asian Americans in the Spirit of Racial Capitalism. It came out last year in 2022. So in many ways, this is the cutting edge of discussions regarding race and theology. And Tran makes a really interesting argument. Tran wants us to reverse how we usually think about race. Rather than thinking that we had racial categories, and then we decided to exploit some of those people in certain categories, Tran argues that a desire to exploit, especially economic exploitation, is what gave rise to racial categories in the first place. Remember, we're trying to uncover its origins, right? So Tran thinks that a lot of contemporary conversations about race, whether on the right or on the left, has gotten the relationship between race and exploitation or domination backwards. Whereas cultural constructionists, like folks like Cone and others, tend to think that racial concepts are pretty much in good working order, but then decide that some folks decided to exploit and dominate some folks in certain racial categories. Tran says it actually goes the other way around. We didn't take stock of all the races that there are in the world and then decide to say, okay, let's enslave these ones, but not these ones. Rather, racial categories emerge from a desire to dominate, from a desire to exploit, from a desire to enslave. And these categories and concepts emerge as justifying apparatuses for these desires to dominate, right? So he's saying we got the cart before the horse. Instead of saying that there was race and then there was exploitation, we said there was always a desire to exploit. So what did we do to make that possible? We invented race, right? So here's what he says. Race was invented to address specific labor problems, including slavery. And it's definitely more than that, but it's also not less. More specifically, the categories white and black designated labor types for the sake of dominative exploitation. Right? We invented these categories for exploitation. Purveyors of this language did not start with a formal category called race and then fill it in with respective content, for example, white, black, and yellow. Rather, white, like its opposite black, named a differentiation that legitimated a practical arrangement, legitimated and made it legit, right? The ontological packaging came later in order to lend great weight to the designations. We didn't first have race and then have white and black with yellow and brown later thrown in. Rather, race is placed on top of a scheme that already assigns some white and some black, a category distinction jerry-rigged to a pre-existing state of affairs. Evacuated of the black-white binary, race loses meaning. Now notice that for Tran, race, not just racism, but racial categories, require a system of domination for it to have meaning. Race has no meaning apart from that system of exploitation and domination. And if he's right, then the efforts we engage in an effort to combat racism have to take that into account. Tran says that most efforts to be anti-racist oddly rely on the very stability of the concepts that they're trying to deny. Tran observes a kind of oddness with respect to what he calls typical anti-racist efforts, or what he calls in the book identitarian anti-racism. While rightly identifying racist practices, those very same categories were what resulted. So whiteness becomes an unstable category constructed out of horrific motivations, but it also becomes a deeply stable category needed for analysis. So whiteness ends up being this like very unreal thing, but also a very real thing at the same time. This is an odd result, thinks Tran. The solution to problematic racial identity is not more racial identity. We end up speaking out of both sides of our mouth, he says. But neither is it to ignore racial identity and racist practices. So here's how he puts it. I thought it odd that anti-racists showed so much confidence in racial identity. The hope of developing an effectively liberative agenda that began and ended with racial identity was not only a losing proposition, but a cursed one. The lesson to be learned could not be willful ignorance of the ongoing consequences of domination, but neither could it be a renewed commitment to racial identity. The latter fails to grasp the meaning of race ideology, just as the former draws on the wrong conclusion from it. We would need something beyond the Scylla of post-racialism and the Charybdis of doubling down on racial identity. All right, that's way too nerdy. Right, he's saying, isn't it odd that we end up using the very same categories to identify problematic racist oppression that we use to cultivate healthier articulations of racial identity? In a New York Times piece, one author observed, why are we still using the same names that the KKK used? Right? That's what Tran is worried about. He's worried that the origins of race were always exploitative. So if we want to combat exploitation, why are we using the same tools that were used to manifest it in the first place? He cites this guy called Peter Colchin, who says, at times race, and more specifically whiteness, is treated as an artificial construct with no real meaning aside from its particular social setting. That's the constructionist element, right? But then at other times, it becomes not only real, but omnipresent and unchanging, deserving attention as an independent force. Race appears as both real and unreal. And this is what happens when we start hearing things like whiteness being talked about as a very like manifest thing that almost has agency, as well as something that's fake, that's a tool used for exploitation, a product of cultural construction. So what we need, says Tran, is to uncover the soil in which racial identity thrives. What function does racism serve? What are racial concepts for? According to Tran, racial concepts were always after-the-fact justifications for exploitation. He thinks that we have been trying to help the Washington Generals play as good as the Globetrotters for far too long, without ever pausing to wonder if maybe the game is rigged. Right? We're still playing basketball, says Tran. And he's got these interesting examples in his book about folks who tried to play the racial category game, and some of them won, but only at the expense and further exploitation of another group, right? Tran wants us to see that the Globetrotters have always had better resources, have always had better equipment, have had the advantage for far too long. Simply improving the Generals loses sight of the broad historical and systemic facts that produced the state of affairs in the first place. Right? Even if the Generals win one game, which apparently they have, right? Even if they win one game, it doesn't resolve the issue of how the Globetrotters came to have as many advantages and privileges as they have. Notice, I'm not talking about basketball. So playing by the rules of the same game doesn't actually produce the anti-racist results that we're looking for. Because even if one team wins out, we don't ever end up asking the question of how the game is broken in the first place. We end up with just as many racial identity categories playing by the same game. So he says, the problem with the cultural constructionist mode of analysis is that it encourages one to look for the presence of certain racial personalities possessed of certain racist attitudes, when, in fact, one should be looking at the structures and systems that often remain faceless and are no less deadly for it. Or again, embracing racial identities that come downstream from radicalization amounts to an intimate embrace of the political economy that produced them. Or in one of my favorite quotes that describes this view, coming from Audre Lorde, the master's tools will never dismantle the master's house. If racial categories were produced, are themselves the master's tools, then they cannot be the very things that we use to dismantle the master's house. So Tran wants us to recognize racism for the insidious force that it really is. And to do that, we can't just pluck up the weeds. We have to analyze the very soil in which these weeds have grown to see what nutrients these weeds thrive on. If all we do is pluck up the weeds, we don't see how the weeds were nurtured in the first place. But that requires noticing the roles that things like exploitation and harm have played in cultivating racial categories in the first place. So here's Tran's summary. He says this, instead of an approach that presumes racial kinds, whether naturally or socially constituted, I advance an account of racial identity as facilitating dominative exploitation. That's what he thinks race is. Race categories are categories that facilitate dominative exploitation through justificatory schemes based on race ideology, an account that conceptually subordinates racial identity to political economy. He's been arguing that racism functions as an ideological justification for dominative exploitation. So that's where we've been. We have two broad understandings of the construction of race. One that says these categories are not altogether problematic, that through the right efforts we can redeem them, somebody like James Cone. And then we have another set of folks who are saying, no, if we really probe into the origins of racial categories, we come to find that they grew out of a soil that is inherently diseased. And for us to better take into account how to live well in God's world, we have to take into account the health of our soil. And so some relevant questions to ask with respect to you know, how we understand race in this way is, well, will there be race in heaven? For a cultural constructionist, the answer would be yes. We will finally have those redeemed racial concepts that provide the experience of liberation necessary for flourishing. For a political constructionist, the answer is no. In heaven, there is no more exploitation. All tears will be wiped away and everything will be made right. So there, if racial categories depend on the soil of exploitation, once that exploitation is taken away, there are no more racial categories. That's an interesting thought, isn't it? But then we can ask, what are the best ways to minister in ways sensitive to racism? Better representation, something broader? Do we need better racial categories or to question racial categories altogether? I'm not going to give you any answers to these, okay? Just so you know, you're probably wondering, what's the answer? I don't know. But could be, frankly, because it may be that the answers you come up with will depend pretty importantly on the community that you find yourself in, right? It's like I said, we have to be accountable to real people who live real lives, who are hurt by real things. And if we talk about race in the abstract, it's never going to be the kind of thing that helps concrete individuals. At the same time, I do want to give you two theological suggestions. I don't want to leave you hanging, okay? I don't want to just hide behind fancy quotes. So I want to give you two theological suggestions. If racism is fundamentally, as Jennings and Tran says, about geographic displacement and economic exploitation, then resisting racism will require a proper theology of place and a proper theology of economy. And with the time that we have left, I'm going to lay those out for you. When it comes to developing a Christian theology of place, we need to draw on the richness of the conceptual resources that we articulate, a vibrant account of, that allow us to confess the gospel in this vibrant way, right? We no longer should be satisfied with reducing things like homes to mere numerical value. We want to see places as belonging to God, as gifts. What do you have that you did not receive, right? So a sense of place requires a reappreciation of a doctrine of creation. Here's how Jennings puts it. The story of Israel connected to Jesus can crack open a life so that others, strangers, even colonized strangers, begin to seep inside and create cultural alienation. Doing so, we experience joining. Loving, caring, intimate joining. That joining is a sharing in the pain, plight, and life of one another. A Christian theology of place, informed by a doctrine of creation, informed by a doctrine of providence, informed by Christ, will begin to see ourselves as formed by one another. I can no longer see my well-being apart from my neighbor's well-being. Her or his well-being now becomes my well-being. Because for me to flourish, I have to exist in the right kinds of relationships with other individuals. And if that is the posture that I adopt towards the world, it becomes much harder to exploit or displace in individuals. So if race requires a relationship to place where we no longer depend on land or on one another, then depending on the land, depending on one another, seeing ourselves as intimately knitted together in Christ by the Holy Spirit for the glory of God takes away the very kinds of things that make racism possible. And importantly, we have to see these kinds of bonds as formed in Christ. We are knit together in Christ. And Jennings makes a big deal about the way that we are knit to how Christ becomes for us a common place of joining. Jennings says this, if a world caught in the unrelenting exchange system of violence was to be overcome, then here is the very means God would use to overcome violence, by the introduction of a new reality of belonging that drew together different peoples into a way of life that intercepted ancient bonds and redrew them around the body of Jesus and in the power of the Spirit. Christ, in the beauty of Christ's atoning work, establishes for us a new space. A space where mutual care can be found. The Holy Spirit knits us together into one, so that we not only find ourselves in the places to which we belong, But those places, those very places where our feet land, become infused with the glory of God. And as this happens, as our desires are transformed, we come to find that the displacing tendencies of racism, those very tendencies that yanked little kids out of their homes and tithed them to the church, those very tendencies become harder and harder to sustain. Because we begin to learn that we are dependent on one another. I need you to thrive, and hopefully you need me too. Because that's how God made us. That's what the church is. Have you thought about the church being a body? Right? If you cut off a piece of your body, the rest of your body feels it, right? In an important way, we need one another to thrive, and recognizing that through a common sense of place is the first step in undercutting the very tendencies that made things like enslavement possible. So we begin with a proper theology of place, but we also need a healthy theology of economy. For Tran, so much of racism is about the economic exploitation of individuals. So what does a Christian account of economy look like? Interestingly, we can actually find the word economy right there in the Bible. But we find that it means something completely different from how we think of economic exchange today. In places like Ephesians 1, 9, and 10, Paul says this, God has made known to us the mystery of his will according to his good pleasure that he set forth in Christ as a plan. And the word plan there is oikonomion, from which we get the word economy. So God's plan or God's economy for the fullness of time to gather up all things in him, things in heaven and things on earth. Here Paul is taking a word from his economic context and converting it for Christian usage. Whereas the word oikonomion in Greek, oikos plus nomos, or household law, right, describes the typical patterns of exchange characterizing a household, which would include the buying and selling of goods, Paul is here saying that not only do we have an economy, but God has an economy too. God has an economy. God has a way of organizing and structuring the world according to God's intent. And all of our little economies ought to conform and fit into that bigger economy. Now, in God's economy, the main characteristic is grace, right? Right? All right, you still with me? You got 5 minutes left. Come on, you're almost out of here. The main characteristic is grace. No argument there. Now, what's interesting is, you know what the word grace means? It just means gift. The word grace just means gift. So when we say that Christ is grace, we are saying that Christ is God's gift to us. That means that God's economy, insofar as it's bringing all things together under Christ, is an economy of gift-giving and mutuality. And yet, our economic practices today tend to be very removed from that. Our economic exchanges today tend to be detached. They tend to be lascivious, really, right? They tend to be reductionistic. We reduce. That's how we operate according to economic exchange. Or we reduce the complexity of a house to a mere number, right? We're detached from the people who make the things that we buy, all in order to justify saving a few cents on the dollar. We consume and we consume, all in the hopes that the things we consume will make us whole as individuals. And as we come to think that all that matters for economic exchange is what can be found on a little price tag. That's all you need to know. It doesn't matter the conditions in which the buyer finds herself or the condition in which the seller finds himself. You either have the money or you don't. But these dynamics are fundamentally at odds with how Christ tells us the world actually is. The world is being brought into reconciliation with Christ, the one who is restoring us holistically. These practices of exploitation, the very soil required for racism, then makes it harder and harder to see that the true gospel economy is the way that the world actually is. It's as if we take off our Christian hats and forget all of our Christian virtues as soon as we pull out our credit cards or think about our practices of buying and selling. This is what Tran says. Racial capitalism takes what is most natural about the world, this economy of grace, and covers it with lies until the divine justice and mercy running through its life is all but forgotten. Through Christ's communion, God returns creation to the integrity of its life. If all we do through economic exchange is remove, reduce, and separate, it should come as no surprise to us that Christians a long time ago made the easy jump of thinking that we can just buy and sell human beings. If the things that constitute, the practices that constitute our economic exchange are entirely removed from us, are entirely separate from our Christian conviction, are entirely separate from the fruit of the Spirit, all of a sudden, these horrific things that seem so appalling to us today become much more thinkable. So if we want to root out the soil in which racism grows, we have to be willing to ask ourselves about the conditions in which it flourishes. Tran gives us the example of a church that started up a software company in an effort to combat the racial inequalities of its community. Part of the DNA of the company was that the CEO could not make more than 3 times the salary of the lowest paid employee of the company. That's a really practical way to be anti-racist. And it should be the kind of thing that's within Christian grasp, but we so often see something like that. And like, you know, very few companies are actually run that way, even those companies that are owned by Christians, right? That level of transparency of saying the CEO will not make 3 times the amount of money as the lowest paid employee, that level of transparency and honesty about our exchange brings us much closer to an attitude where we don't lay up treasures on earth, but lay up treasures in heaven. I feel like I remember reading that somewhere. But as we do that, we find that the soil that racism thrives within becomes more and more unable to sustain the very acts that characterize racist practice. Right? So we take a look at our economic exchange. This is just the beginning. And I hope that you'll be able to have more and more conversation about this as you go along. But I want to leave you with this. This is the take home. Sin creates in us the desire for domination, exploitation, and displacement. That's what Jennings has told us. That's what Tran has told us. But in Christ, we share a common object of love, leading us to depend on one another, care for one another, and constitute a common life where individuals are valued and not exploited. And in such a gospel context, race cannot exist. So, thank you. See you around.
Thanks for listening. This has been a Dwell Community Church production.